And at this time, we would like to introduce our speaker. And tonight we have Maura, and she's come all the way to us from Bethesda, Maryland.
Hi, I'm Maura. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Maura.
As far as coming from Bethesda, it was a straight shot on highway, and I've never really been told that anything in any means of servicing Alcoholics Anonymous was optional to me. Definitely not by sponsorship, and definitely not by example. So I didn't think anything of it. I just asked for which date was most convenient and did it. I pray to keep that attitude. And once I get in my story, I can say, you know, I'm definitely no saint. I didn't come to that attitude off of volition. I came to it from, you know, the typical alcoholic way, which is just bashing your head against a wall, you know, with self-will, and then bashing it even more. And then, you know, finally, when there's nothing left, you know, you pick up the right way. But a little bit about my story. So I have a sobriety date, and it's August 16th, 2012. It's not my first sobriety date. Oh, thank you very much. I have a sponsor. Has taken me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as laid out in the big book. I have had probably the best experience of my life has been sponsoring other women. My home group is Howard County Speakers. It's an hour-long speaker format. It's in Elkridge, Maryland, technically, which is like right next to Columbia, and it's at 8:30 on Tuesday nights, and definitely invite you out there. A little bit about my story, and just a preface, I do look like I'm 16, but I'm not, so. There is no reason for me to be an alcoholic. I am not a random victim of circumstances. Nothing horrible has happened to me. In fact, I would argue that I was spoiled rotten growing up, both by love and by physical things. You know, starting from a very young age, I just became like obsessed with more. You know, like, at first it starts manifesting, like, I have a sleepover with a friend, and, you know, I'm crying by the time I have to get home because I want 10 sleepovers, and it just wasn't enough fun, you know? You know, my mom throws me, like, a surprise birthday party, you know, and I get Furby, which is, like, the toy that we all wanted back when we were younger, you know, but then the birthday party ends, and I'm, like, devastated because it wasn't a week long, you know? And, like, I could sum up being an alcoholic by the fact that by the time I was in second grade, my mother was writing, "Please think of others," on my hand when I went to school. Like, boom. You know, I'm wired to, like, satiate myself, and yet I don't know what I'm satiating. It's just this, like, inordinate longing, and I don't know what it's for. I don't know if I'm hungry. I don't know if I'm emotional. I can't really deal with emotions that well, so I don't try to process that. I just feel this, like, longing, and I just want more, because possibly if I try everything out there, something's going to cure this itch. So, you know, when you're young, it's like a bunch of cupcakes, or, like, I remember for one birthday, I wanted 9 orders. I was turning 9, and I wanted 9 orders of my favorite dumplings, which is, like, you know, no 9-year-old in the world could possibly eat, but I wanted 9 orders, because something's not right with me, you know, and I need something. I don't know what it is, you know, and I'm 9 years old, and I just know that I need something, you know, something's missing. So my parents have kind of chalked this up to Maura has ADHD, and get me really involved in physical activity. And they put me in Irish dancing, which, if you guys know what that is, like river dance or Lord of the Dance, if you ever heard of that, I got into that, like, so competitively. You know, my Monday nights I drove to, the dance teacher held his class in Annapolis every weekend. Starting, they switched my classes around at the school I was at. I applied for independent sport at the private school I was at, and I would go up Fridays through Sundays to New York, and I would have dance classes. And, you know, when you're putting in like 30 hours a week of dancing on top of school, I think that that tired me out enough physically so that I wasn't feeling that longing, because I wasn't feeling much, you know, besides the blisters on my heels and like the stress fractures and the tendons and, you know, 6 hours of rehearsal, you do feel that. I loved dancing. Like, I was born to dance. You know, it was a very good temporary solution to Mora before I became a teenager. When I became a teenager, Irish dancing wasn't exactly the cool thing. I missed every going out, any sort of party or social event, because on the weekends I went to train in New York City. I ended up, you know, I had a stress fracture. I didn't want to stop dancing on it. I wanted to go to this one competition in Ireland, and I kept dancing on it. And I did a certain move, and the whole room resonated with a crack, and that was my dancing career. I broke a bone in my foot into two pieces, and the first doctor I saw was like, you're never going to walk without a limp again, let alone dance. And I went to this, like, really, you know, progressive, the guy who makes, he actually makes metal, like, legs for amputees so they can run a marathon and stuff like that. My mom got me in for an appointment with him, and he was like, here's the deal, you know, we can screw this bone back together, but it'll be about a year of physical therapy and a lot of praying. So in the meantime, I remember the very first night I was home for the first time ever with me sitting with me. And I'm like 15 years old. This is after, like, you know, a hard day at prep school. I'm sitting, like, alone with myself. And there was no bad kids. There was no, like, me in and of myself was like, I need a drink. I knew from a very young age, just from, like, eyeing it. And just I had this, like, instinct that, like, that was the elixir. I just knew. And so, like, after this hard day of prep school, because I couldn't just sit, like, on a Tuesday night with myself, I went downstairs and I mixed everything I could find. It was warm when it went down, and I drunk dialed everybody I knew. And thus started me drinking alone in my room at, like, 15 years old. And what would happen was, you know, I'm an alcoholic, so I don't know if you relate to this, but I would black out and drink too much and lose control of my body, my bodily functions, name it. And I'm 15, okay? So I'm a child living in my parents' home. And when I'm not at a party. So I'm, like, drunk, blacking out, doing what we do, terrorizing them in their home, waking them up at 3 in the morning. And they're like, are you drunk on a Thursday evening? Like, what, you're 15. And I was. High school for me was terrorizing my parents in their own home. They didn't allow me out much after they started witnessing me drinking alone in my room. So I just terrorized them in their home. I robbed them of every ounce of peace that they could possibly wish to have. I burst into their room at 3 in the morning. I damaged their house. I threw up all over their house. And when it was time to go to college, there had been a couple of instances where I had found my way out of the house. One such incident, I was driving a car and retired in the middle of a lane of 95, and a cop pulled up to the car, and I accosted him for being in my bedroom. And, I don't know why this happened, but this is what happened. He said, give me your phone. I'm not dealing with you. And he called my parents. And again, it's like, you know, Wednesday night and I'm 17. And this cop is like, your daughter has, like, an empty bottle of gin in her car and she's, like, obstructing traffic and accosting me. Can you please get her off my hands? And I don't remember any of this. I do remember the cop, and I do remember saying, what are you doing in my bedroom? But I was literally that. I when I drink, I lose all track of time, placement, people. To the best of my knowledge, I was in my room doing what I usually do. And time and space and circumstances were taking place all around me all the time, and I just would come to all of a sudden. And so when I went off to college, like, just to speed this up, I joined a sorority, and I mean, that should say enough. I truthfully do not remember my college experience. And some people giggle at that, and it is funny in a sense, but, like, my parents paid millions of dollars for an education that I rarely went to. I found out how to manipulate the system, which is how that's what we do. I found out how to charm teachers. I found out how to lie and tell sob stories and get extensions that I didn't deserve. And I don't remember what happened to my body for 4 years. And being like a little girl at College Park, that's a little problematic. So that is the extent of my college career. At the end of my college career, the current temporary solution to Mora was that if I just dated this person, it was like this social stuff, like going out, getting attention. If you tell me I'm pretty, maybe I'll believe it. If you tell me you love me, and my two other boyfriends that I have tell me they love me, maybe that will be enough. I had started what I just thought, I thought of it as a social inconvenience. I was peeing the bed every night. And I really couldn't land, you know, the fraternity president that I thought was going to save me. But when I was peeing the bed, and this is that's the scope of my world at this time. That's it. I don't have values intrinsically. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. My goals are to, like, land a fraternity president and, like, possibly land as, like, you know, they had this thing, like, hot or not, like, hottest sorority girl, and like, possibly land on that. Those are my goals. And my parents are paying millions of dollars for my education, and I've been kicked out of the honors program, which is the reason that I went to this college. So I start to pee the bed every single night, and I went to see a specialist who did, like, a live scan of my kidney and bladder and kidneys. Excuse me, there's two. And he took me into a consultation room, and he said, "Little girl, if you don't stop drinking the way you're drinking, you're going to be incontinent and have a plastic bag by the time you're 25. Your urinary system is that of a 75-year-old woman." And I was like, to your plaques, because you graduated from 12 years medical school, and, like, you know, I can't even remember the last time I went to a class. You don't know. You don't know. You're old, and you don't know how much kids drink today. Telling my sponsor that came out of my mouth was a venture. But that's what I said to him. I said, "You're old, and you don't know how much kids drink today." I said, "How much do I pay you?" And I left. A couple weeks later, I was, I thought I pulled a muscle in my back. I kept popping ibuprofen, and the next thing I know, I'm hit with this, like, delirious fever. If you've had the DTs, it was a lot like that, because I've had them too. And I was, like, delirious, and I have a fever, and I'm sweating, and I'm cold. It's very sudden, and I was keeping very good company at this time, you know, caliber people. So someone just plopped my body into the front doorstep of my sorority house, and my sorority took me to the emergency room because I was, like, imagining things and burning up. And when I got there, I was with my, I think we were 20 at the time, and he already had 4 DUIs. So that was my standards, you know? Like, if I dated somebody, like, isn't love your running buddy? I mean, anything that I have that's good, I have been taught and given by Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have these things in my own volition. I'm just an alcoholic. So, you know, a running buddy, somebody who's going to keep me drunk and clean up my messes, that sounds like love to me. And so I was in a relationship with somebody like that. We went to the emergency room. They were mad that I was making them miss their fraternity party. So I yanked out my IV. What ended up happening is my kidney was essentially shutting down. And it was swollen and lacerating, and you get a fever when you have internal bleeding. So that's why I had a fever. And they're telling me this serious news. The first thing I do is dial my parents and tell them that my kidney has exploded and I'm dying in a hospital and hang up on them. Then I pull out my IV and I flee the hospital in a nightgown and underwear. Like in the little gown that they give you and underwear. And with, you know, my alcoholic 4 DUI boyfriend, and we run into a cab that we don't have money for. We drive about a half an hour, then ninja roll out of the cab, and we run into his fraternity party. And I show up at this party with half of an IV sticking out and a nightgown in my underwear. And I told you I'd, you know, because this is what I do. It's like I absolutely – my parents are probably – never slept. I believe my mom was being medicated during this time. And my dad was showing up to College Park at least once a week, unannounced, just because I didn't answer my phone, wasn't accountable to the world around me. Life on life's terms is, I can't do all that. So I told you that I placed that call. They woke up my sister, and the three of them spent the whole night calling hospitals in between D.C. and Baltimore, trying to find out where Moore was. And they, when they finally located where I was, they said, you know, we can't tell you anything other than you need to find her and get her back into the hospital. She's very, very sick, and it's very serious. So I woke up in the fraternity house in a nightgown and underwear with an IV sticking out, drunk, with my father standing over the bed. And he grabbed me by the arm, and he was like, get in the car. And that should qualify me. You know, that's usually the only story I tell, and people are like, wow, keep coming back. But, you know, I would love to tell you that that was enough and that I was, like, hanging my head in shame and that all I wanted to do was to be a good person and to be the type of person that my family raised and taught me amazing work ethic, values. You know, I was made to have a job from the time I was 16 on. I'm an alcoholic, so I never held them, but, you know, the principle was there. And, like, you know, I was put into dancing and other sports, and, you know, I was expected, you know, to get good grades. I was given an amazing moral principles galore, and they just couldn't be beaten into me. Like, I could only learn via spiritual awakening and, like, language of the heart from other alcoholics. You know, like, if unconditional love could have kept me sober, I never would have drank. And I just want to put that out there because I'm beyond blessed, you know, speechless as to, like, how blessed I am with my family. But I just, I'm an alcoholic. You know, even what ended up happening is, you know, I had to take incompletes for courses. I had to be given IV medicine for about a week in the ICU. My kidneys were like, we're done with you is what was going on. I didn't stop drinking. When I first got sober, it was May of 2009. And I think what had happened was my ego had gotten bruised enough. I was sick of public scenes, urinating the bed, everyone being mad at me, having to duck people or put my hood up when I walked across campus, having to hear what I did the night before. I did start to get the tremors and panic attacks the next morning. The shame and the remorse, again, all ego stuff, you know? And thus was my sobriety. Like, exactly mirrored that. You know, I came in, I went to treatment. When I got out of treatment, they sent me to a halfway house. I was 22 at the time. And I inherently got 10 times worse. Every single day that I was at the first halfway house I was at, and I mean every single day, I was tested. And they were like, she must be on those basalt things that at the time you couldn't tell in the P-test. They were like, she's got to be on, you know, something. I was, when you took the drink away from me, I was just a spiritual malady run riot. I have no solution at this point. Your steps on the wall, that's not fast enough, you know, for what I need. I need relief. Those, like, I'm not used to taking instruction. I don't have reverence for authority. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I knew enough. Like, I knew the language of the heart. I knew how you guys felt, and I knew that I was one of you. I just, you know, complete powerlessness was not on the table. You know, I had drinking a lot when I went to college, and there were some people who really needed to be in here, you know, as far as I was concerned. And I was really smart, and I had a good education that I don't remember and didn't attend. And, you know, I wasn't done. And so, you know, suggestions were suggestions, and no thank you, I know better. You know, I was given a period of grace by God. Like, literally, I think he just kept me alive and tried to keep me out of the way of others as much as possible. And what I did for those 3 years was plug in and drain and plug in and drain and plug in and drain. Eating disorder. I'm going to dye my hair. I'm going to shop with money I don't have. I'm going to have a boyfriend. I'm going to have 4 boyfriends. Rules don't apply to me. You know, I have extreme entitlement issues and rules don't apply to me. And what I can say about that is, like, I honestly, and I say this in my prayers every single night, I don't want that to be anybody's experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. To go through a program of principles that teaches God reliance and essentially being your brother's keeper, and to rob, steal, cheat, and lie is like a burden you don't want to carry. You may be able to, like, I was able to fake it. You know, I was able to put on a lot of masks. I think I can make the outside look presentable. But eventually that will catch up to you, you know, and that's something that I carry in my heart every single moment of every single day. And then I constantly have to do inventory to clear, because I was walking around in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, essentially, you know, kind of going like this to the big book, and then treating sobriety like a security camera. Okay. So when I'm on the camera, you know, like, perfect. And, like, I can recite so many lines from the big book that I sat around the night before and memorized, because I knew that, you know, this old timer and this old timer is going to be there. And I knew if I just spat out some big book lines that I have no idea what they're talking about, you know, that I would receive validation from those old timers, you know, and that, like, I don't know, I could fool people. And you don't know this is all going on at the time. Like, disease is just so manipulative and cunning that, I don't even know that, like, I'm the fool this whole time. I just continue to lie, cheat, and steal sober and expect to stay sober. A God of my understanding is not I don't think I mentioned the word. I think I was my own God of my understanding, which is why I relapsed. Even when I did the steps, I did the steps a lot, actually, and what I would do was I would pick sponsors that, like, I wanted to impress. Like, it's just this egotistical sobriety. And I would, like, give them a poster presentation of this God of my understanding, you know, and intellectualize the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous when it's a spiritual experience. Like, this is a spiritual program. Like, to take the spirituality out of it is to take, like, the wet out of water. And I'm intellectualizing and, like, you know, I start to work at Father Martin's, so then I think I'm really cool. I'm like this sober exemplar in my mind. And, you know, I'm having these conversations with patients and then being like, service, 12-step, like, you know, and I'm clocked in and I'm getting paid for this. And I urge you to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It does not say anywhere that if you're getting paid for service, that is service in Alcoholics Anonymous. But all of these things are like without like my step one in this complete admission of powerlessness, I have so many like original ideas and I have so many plots and plans and I have so many but ifs and like you don't understand me and like I'm unique and like on a daily basis, my sponsor will say to me like, welcome to the rest of the world, just one of God's kids, no better, no worse. That's where you are, just one of. And I love that today. I celebrate being just one of God's kids today, because I can tell you being chronically unique led to relapse while working at Father Martin's, attending 7 meetings, you know, a week for my ego's sake, because I want to hear myself get called on. I want to talk about things that I don't know about in Alcoholics Anonymous. To pull that all down in your head, you know, at the time it is disguised as the worst thing that ever happened to me. Only in retrospect for me to know that, like, that experience let me know that anything that is disguised as the worst thing that's ever happened to me inevitably is going to be the best thing that ever happens to me. To be stripped of, you know, my entitlement and my alcoholic ego was the best thing that ever happened to me. And truly, I'm an alcoholic, so you have to strip me of everything before I'm going to take God as the solution to me. You know, I want something else. I want something fancier. I want something shinier. I want something quicker than, you know, you're an alcoholic and the only solution to what you have is God. That just wasn't going to work for me the first time. And so, you know, I just, like, I relapsed in, like, just the way that we do, just, like, publicly, like, you know, I'm living in a house with all sober people. I'm working at Father Martin's. And you can't do drugs and work at Father Martin's. And, you know, and one thing I need to mention about that time is that, you know, God was with me even when I had just blatantly disregarded him for those 3 years of sobriety. Before I was about to pick up, it flashed into my mind that I should hit my knees because, like, God is always there. And I feel like especially that God especially loves his alcoholics. That's just my opinion. That's also been my experience. God loves his alcoholics, and I just wouldn't do it. You know, I wasn't rendered powerless yet, and, like, why am I going to pray? I still have ideas to try. I still have plots and plans, and I was going to do this, like, get out of my way. And that was my whole sobriety, you know, like, thanks for your suggestion. I'm going to do this. And I pray for you. I sincerely that that's not your experience. It is the most painful way to go, and you will carry, you know, that person who did those things with you. Like, you know who you are when you put your head down on the pillow every night. You know what you've done. You know who you've hurt, and you know the truth about yourself, especially if you've done these inventories as laid out in the big book, you know? And, I can tell you, there's not a time where I don't do an inventory from these 3 years of my sobriety where I don't burst out crying. It's ugly. You know, the truth's about myself. And the ugliest part about this is that I had been, you know, in what had started out like a really healthy relationship that was really cool. You know, at least they were cool. You know, they had a really amazing program and like this whole like spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were running around on fire for this thing. And I directly served as cancer to their spirituality. I ended up taking that person back out with me. And I can tell you again, that's not something that you ever want to be having to put your head down on the pillow at night and thinking about. And having done several inventories on this, you know, I'm mentioning this because, when both people came back from the relapse, we came back drastically different people. You know, it's not just AA's here and I know where it is, you know, when I'd like to recover and stop doing what I'm doing. It does not go down like that. Also, your disease doing push-ups in the parking lot is a farce. Throw it out the door. Your disease is progressing as if you're using every single day. And so when I had a relapse for about 6 months, and I was homeless in a car with a little dog, and I came back with every aspect of the spiritual malady that you've ever heard presented, you know, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot look people in the eye. I have a panic attack when I enter a meeting, which is, you know, the place that I need to go to get my solution, but it's full of people. You know, I still to this day struggle so hard with people approval and just like need you to like me for me to like myself. You know, that still hasn't left me yet. All these things, like, I came back with as if like my spiritual malady had gotten the chance to exercise those 3 years that like I was technically dry. You don't pick up where you left off. You pick up like you never stopped. And you know, it was the case of this person too. And what ended up happening is, I willingly participated, in an abusive relationship. And then I wanted to wave the flag and bring this issue into Alcoholics Anonymous. And before inventory, all I could say was that, like, I was a victim of this circumstance. And being a woman, I can go around and get the sympathy and the justification that I need, in that circumstance. But I am so fortunate to have members of Alcoholics Anonymous who made me put these incidences on paper, where I can first mention, you know, that I set the ball rolling. You know, I started a relapse and I took this person down with me, you know? And I was also told about the traditions and, like, you know, I was told things like, Maura, these are outside issues and we don't talk about other members of Alcoholics Anonymous within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Completely inappropriate. And that person needs to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, obviously, you know, just as much as you do. They're spiritually sick. And I mention this because, you know, this was a resentment and a situation that, I mean, I was unable to, like, look at my part or sort through. I really couldn't even distinguish the true from the false in Alcoholics Anonymous because these events would happen and then this person would go speak at the podium. And I was like, AA is putting them at the podium, you know, and I just couldn't separate anything. And I urge you, if you're ever going through, you know, anything that might blur your vision of Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely the only and the best solution to what you have. Talk to members of Alcoholics Anonymous. People did inventory with me ad nauseum, never losing, you know, I never lost faith, they never lost faith in me. You know, this process works. That's all that they would say to me. And I did 8 inventories and was able to come to complete clarification with this situation. You know, there is nothing that Alcoholics Anonymous does not have a solution for in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, again, my circumstance was so unique. This was different. I was, you know, this person is speaking Alcoholics Anonymous. They're putting him at the podium. Absolutely not. And all of this is explained to me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and by a sponsor who can navigate the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, just straight up. You know, anything that we view that is done unto us, I know that, like, that's such a prime position for me to be in. I love to play the victim. Like, you did something to me, you know, like, and I can bat my eyes, you know, and thank God for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were just like, Maura, I love you too much. And, you know, victims don't get to stay sober. And like at the time I was like, whew, like, you know, like I am an abused woman, like absolutely not. And even if I am, there are millions upon millions of women who have walked before me through Alcoholics Anonymous using just God and the spiritual principles and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and have come through it the other end because Alcoholics Anonymous works. So, you know, quit the complaining and get into the action, which is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous about it, you know. And that is just not only just relapsing, but that experience. I have not come across anything where I don't have a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can go to who will point to me like an exact action I can do in the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've used that resentment prayer for that situation after doing, you know, my many inventories as they're laid out in the big book. And, like, that's gone for me today. You know, I have a family member who is, it's been about 8 years of us, you know, what I would love to see progress in this relationship. There really is none. I'm pointed to like the resentment prayer in the big book. I'm pointed to the step about amends, which I would love to touch on, because I was under a little bit of a pretense about the amends. I thought the amends were for me. Like, I need peace. So I'm going to, like, you know, call you up and insert myself into your life and, you know, give you this whole jazz deal about how, like, I'm cured now, you know, and, like, I am the Dalai Lama and you should really forgive me. Again, thank God for people who went before us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for my sponsor, who, like I said, on a daily basis is like, oh, Maura. You know, and she says things like, actually about the Dalai Lama. I remember I went through this phase where I was like posting a lot of like very spiritual stuff. You know how we are. And my sponsor called me up and she was like, how you doing? And I was like, oh, just feeling really good, on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, how are you? And she was like, you know, stop talking like the Dalai Lama and then having a meltdown once a week to me. She was like, that's living a lie. You know, that's putting a falsity out there. You know, I know that you would like to be that enlightened, but you're just not yet. And so that's putting a lie out there to suggest that you're that consistent or that enlightened. And then she hung up. And, like, thank God for that. Thank God, because all I ever did was walk through the world and just, like, ruffle every feather of everyone around me. That's what I do inherently. You know, I offend, I harm, I ruffle feathers. And I have a sponsor, you know, and I have a book that has written instructions for what to do in anything I might come across in life. You know, what I want to say about making amends to other people. Again, I had mentioned, you know, I think it's the alcoholic belief that, like, I just want to run through these amends, get some peace. And my sponsor was like, how dare you? She was like, amends is nothing to do with you. Amends is repairing, it's like repairing a fence. You don't go to a fence and say you're sorry and then walk away from it and it's still, you know, shards sticking up all over the place. She was like, you do not go into anybody's life until you've had, you know, until it's instructed by her, until, you know, there's a vital spiritual experience that makes you a different person. So that inherently you're walking in as a different person. And quite frankly, don't go barging into anyone until you run it by me. And she's like, it's, again, like the fence. You don't go to a broken fence and say, I'm sorry, and walk away. You have to bring a plan of action that's specifically tailored to this person, you know, in consideration of the direct harms and specific harms that you did to them, about how you wish to repay this. And you have to take in consideration how you think they need to be loved, how you think they need to be mended. I really appreciate the amends being explained that way because, you know, having a very different experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you that, you know, and Sandy said it really perfectly before the meeting, you know, it's my intent to be walking around doing things as a servant of God from the valor of my heart. I do not want to do these things from alcoholic ego. I don't want to do them because I want to look good in front of old timers. I don't want to do them because I want to check off a list so I can stay sober. I have a lot of moral... I have a lot of time where my primary purpose was to be helping other alcoholics, where I just took. And so this is vitally important to me that I'm carrying these principles in all my affairs. It is vitally important to me that I'm making amends where I'm actually bringing peace to other people. It is vitally important to me that if I'm asked to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, that I don't ever even think about it. I just do it. You know, it's vitally important to me that when my sponsor says stuff, that I never interpret it, that I just do it. I had because of the way that my sponsor has explained and kind of organized my amends, I have had amazing immense experiences, but the other person has had, you know, like it really has been about the other person. My amends thus far in my sobriety, because my God absolutely has a sense of humor, has been people literally like knocking on my doors being like, I know what you're doing with your life. I know you do Alcoholics Anonymous and like the amends. You know, I've had that happen like 12 times. I can't even tell you. And my sponsor's just like, ha ha, like. And, you know, what that's looked like for me is that, like, in that case, you know, there's no doubt that I'm using my, like, alcoholic interpretation to go walking into their life. They're coming to me. And, you know, I do a lot of praying before I walk into that situation because there's always the chance that I could bring my, like, alcoholic harmful self. And I talk to my sponsor and we come up with a plan about, you know, specifically catered to the harms that I did to that person, you know, not just like reach in for number six that you did for that one person and do it for this one again. And so I've done a lot of like asking, I've done a lot of like thinking about how I feel that like that person needs to be loved. You know, how I think that person needs to be taken care of. And the amends this time around have been the highest point of my sobriety. Highs that are not achievable by synthetics, not at all. Because what we're all looking for, and I trust me because I looked for all the other temporary things. And if you have a method you would like to try, run it by me. I'm sure I've done it. You know, what's wrong with us? You know, and this was said back by, you know, Carl Jung or Jung, however you pronounce that. This was said back when Carl Jung, he represents like the greatest human power of all time at his time. You know, he was the greatest doctor of his time and like he saw Roland Hazard. You know, and his opinion of alcoholics was quite simply that, like, alcoholics are people with an inordinate longing for God. Like, that is what's wrong with us, you know? And when I go and be my brother's keeper, or I sow a seed of love, which is something that, you know, Steve always says to me. And it's this analogy that, like, I can't part without sharing, which just, like, gives me chills. You know, he's like, more your two missions on earth are basically to sow seeds of love and be your brother's keeper. And again, like, me swallowing those kind of concepts before when I had, like, my entitlement issues and my ego, I just can't even imagine. But, you know, having relapsed and truly pulled the world down on my head for, you know, the millionth time and been able to really resonate to the idea of powerlessness and powerlessness over everything. Not just powerlessness over alcohol. Like, I'm truly powerless in this world around me. I have no power source. I feel powerless all the time, and my only hope is plugging into a never-ending supply of power. And the only supply that there is like that is not man-made. It's God. So the sowing seeds of love analogy that I just, you know, Farns always says, he's like, you know, your basic mission in life is to sow seeds of love. Everything that you do, in other words, should be this action, you know, what would love do, you know? And, if you think about a farmer sowing seeds, you can throw these seeds out there. And some seeds are going to fall upon shade. Some are going to fall upon rocks. Some are going to bloom right away. Some are not going to bloom. And all of a sudden they spread out, you know, in the fifth season. The point being is that you just sow seeds of love. You just do what love would do, and you don't control at all the results. You don't get to pick that seedling and make it sprout at all. You know, you might sow a seed of love and be hoping for Prince Charming, and like in my story, like I got this woman that I pick up every Wednesday from a shelter, and I know that she is a direct result of sowing seeds of love in my life. It was this woman. I feel God because I feel God through his kids, and I feel God every time I'm with her. And like, I cannot wait for Wednesdays with Dale, you know, and she's like 55 and I'm 28, and like, she's my dear friend and I love her, and I can't wait for Wednesdays, and I want to hear about her life, and I want to experience God just how I do when I'm just like being with one of his kids, you know, talking language of the heart. And, you know, I think sometimes we do kind of with intent want to sow these seeds of love to get X, Y, and Z, you know, like I'd love to sow seeds of love and, you know, work for a Fortune 500 company. That would be great. But that's not the principle. That's not doing it with the valor of your heart. That's not doing it from the God part in you. And that's the only way that it works, if you're just sowing seeds of love to do what love would do. And the emphasis on that is that love comes back to you. That's just the way that spiritual principles work. Spiritual principles apply to everyone evenly, whether you believe it or not. You know, just like gravity. If I stood on top of a building and this gentleman stood on top of a building, he didn't believe in gravity, I did. We both jumped off. Did it matter who didn't believe in gravity? No, we're both gone. You know, and so sowing seeds of love, these spiritual principles are going to apply to me whether I believe in them or not. And these spiritual principles are laid out for us in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and what they boil down to is a relationship with a higher power being my brother's keeper and sowing seeds of love. My life today, I would argue I err on the side of, you know, I still have what alcoholics have, which is like this, like, dependence on, you know, all things but God, you know, and these false human things, you know, like I'm very sponsor reliant. I'll just say that, you know, it crushes me when like I walk by, you know, a group of girls and, you know, I, because I'm an alcoholic, I'm perceiving that they're talking about me, you know, and then I'm crying to my sponsor because I'm like, why doesn't everybody love me? You know, like I'm an alcoholic, you know, I'm not cured. I never will be. But I think that I have at least a good shot at remaining humble, so long as I picture my sobriety like this, and this will be the last thing I say, and this is borrowed, so if you didn't get anything from what I said, just take this, because I know that this is from a good source. My duty on this earth, my primary purpose, and what the steps shape me for is to be a mail carrier. You know, and this is all an analogy, but And being a mail carrier, I get to work for this Fortune 500 company, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to live this life beyond my wildest dreams. I get to, you know, work for this company that has benefits beyond anything I can comprehend. Great benefits, the best life I could possibly live if I work for this company. But all I am is the mail carrier, you know. And that might not resonate with my ego all the time, but I get to work for this company, like I said, and I get to potentially have a life that someone like me could never dream of. You know, I can't even have a bank account, so like, let alone a well-rounded life. And so I get to work for this company, and I work in the mailroom. You know, and my purpose is to literally receive messages and to be a conduit, and then I deliver those messages in the means that he would have me and to the people that he would have me. If I live my life in that purpose of just seeking to be a conduit, just seeking to be a message carrier, and doing it as he would have me, and kind of like, you know, doing his works well, then I have a shot at this thing, you know? I just want to say, I want to thank everybody for having me out. I did not know this was your meeting's anniversary. I'm so sorry that you had to have me for that. But I'm honored to be asked to come anywhere tonight. I'm truly honored. This sobriety, every single day of it, is a huge blessing to me, for which I'm extremely grateful. Every single day is a miracle. It's still new. It's still exciting. And I just hope to keep it. And I think I have a shot if I just stay close to God and perform his works well. So thank you for having me out. Thanks for the show.
The group would very much like to thank Maura for sharing her experience with us tonight on our anniversary. Great job. This group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has a working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise your hands? All right, and Rich has something to say. Rich, ready?
Sure. My name's Rich. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mara. Just want to give you a little rundown of the history of the group. Something I've been doing for a few years now, and I've promised myself year in and year out that I was going to type up some notes so I had something to read, but as you can see, I have not done that. So the history is going to come from my heart, from what I've gathered over the years. This is going to sound awfully familiar to Mara. I believe that this whole thing kind of started in the Baltimore area. There was this Zen Buddhist truck driver with a fifth grade education named Wally. And some guy by the name of Tom came to him, a drunken businessman, Irish, red face. And Tom asked Wally for help, and Wally gave him help. And Tom grasped onto the idea of love and service to God and his fellow man. And so they were doing that in the Baltimore area. And then this dude, this Navy pilot, who had been sober for a while, but he's still very sick. He actually wasn't at that point in time sowing any seeds of anything. And this gentleman by the name of Steve F. Heard Tom share his message down in Baltimore, and Steve asked Tom for help. And Tom showed Steve how to sow seeds of love. And so Steve started hanging around in Baltimore. They started a meeting down there in 1996, I believe. Help me here. Harbor City Speakers Group. And so they were doing that for a while, and then Steve ran into this psycho, alcoholic addict up in Boston by the name of Greg H. And Greg asked Steve for help, and Steve gave him help, and Greg started to learn about sowing seeds of love, and he moved to York for a while, and then ended up getting a job with some multi-gazillionaire tycoon dude up in Reelsville, and this is about 02, and started going to meetings in the Quaker Town, Purple Sea area, and he met a young man by the name of Chris M., who had been sober for a little while but wasn't sowing a whole lot of seeds of anything, and Chris asked Greg for help, and Greg showed Chris what was showed to him. And they started hanging together, and I guess it was about, well, they just had enough of some of the meetings. That, you know, you hear the cliche that, oh, you need to start a new meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous is a resentment in a coffee pot. I don't believe that this group was born from that. Anyway, somewhere along the line in early 05, this drunken tree man shows up in Quaker Town and meets Greg. And anyway, so, you know, we got a bunch of guys that are sober, and we're going to meetings, and we're trying to help others. And all of a sudden, there was like a yearning for a different type of meeting. And Greg and Chris got together in the winter of 04-05 and said we ought to start a speaker meeting in Quakertown. And they talked to Steve down in Baltimore and wherever he was at that point in time, and got a little format together, and we got a church. And on March 27, 2006, Feet First was born. That's how we started. That's how it started. Two guys just wanting to get a meeting where we brought speakers from other areas who were carrying a message of hope, recovery through the 12 steps as they're outlined in a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and love and service to God and others. And so that's what we've been trying to do for 9 years now. Our original church was over in Sellersville, and I think we outgrew it, or our insurance went bad or whatever, and we ended up in this church, and it's been a wonderful experience ever since. This is not an ego thing. This is something that I hold very dear to my heart. You know, I've been a member of this group since its beginning, and a large percentage of my recovery has occurred in this church and out in the, under the pavilion. And you know, Greg said to me a couple of weeks before this group started, he said, Rich, what have you been doing on Monday nights? And I said, I've been going to the same meeting I met you at last year. And he said, well, we're starting a new meeting, and I'd like you to come. And I said, why? What's the big deal? And he said, because we need you there. I had absolutely no idea what he meant. But today, standing here before you, I know exactly what he meant. And I'm blessed to have had the opportunity to be a member of this group. And I want to thank all of you who have been here for the group, who have been here since the early times, and even if tonight is your first meeting here, to allow to have made Feet First the group that it is today, serving God and others. Thank you.